The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome in as students of the game. My name is Alex Bauman, and today I'm joined by just Nathan Glidewell. Avery Oldenburg will hopefully be back with us next week. Coming in AAA, the first story we have today is the Philadelphia 76ers dismissed head coach Doc Rivers after the team blew a 3-2 series lead to the Boston Celtics in the Eastern Conference semifinals. Nathan, I know you haven't been a big fan of Doc Rivers in the past, so what are your thoughts on the 76ers go ahead and cutting bait and getting rid of him?
Yeah, you know, this was the one firing I actually agreed with. All the other ones, you know, you can talk about Nick Nurse, we can talk about Monty Williams, we can talk about Mike Budenholzer, but this one was warranted. Doc Rivers has now lost 10 game sevens. It is unbelievable that someone would just lose one, but it seems like every single time that a Doc Rivers coach team gets into the postseason, they're always losing in the game seven. You really wonder at what point do you just like let Doc Rivers just coach regular season, get you the good record, then just let him go before the postseason, because that's what it seems you have to do now. And it can't be just the players at this point, because it's a consistent basis. He doesn't make any good changes as a head coach. He makes no adjustments in game, or at least no smart adjustments in game, and it just loses. You know, his team loses. I have no answer for him. I don't know what to do in his case. It honestly seems like his time in coaching is almost coming to an end.
Yeah, Doc Rivers is the definition of having success in the regular season and going to the playoffs and absolutely just crapping the bed. I mean, he just can't do anything right. It's not all on him. You had a couple years ago with Ben Simmons in the playoffs against the Hawks specifically. You know, he couldn't do anything right. He was scared to shoot the ball. There was a moment where he had Trae Young on him in the post and passed out of it instead of going for a layup. I mean, there's that with Ben Simmons. And then in this game, the game seven that they lost, Joel Embiid and James Harden combined for like, I think, 24, 25 points. You can't have your two superstars combine for that many points and expect to win a basketball game, especially in the Eastern Conference semifinals. It's not all on Doc Rivers, but we've seen in the past coaches get scapegoated out if their team doesn't get success. We've seen it with Monty Williams this offseason, Mike Budenholzer, guys like that. And I think Doc Rivers, like you mentioned, Nathan, out of those three, was the most deserving to get fired. He hasn't been able to get over the hump. The Sixers can't make the Eastern Conference finals ever, it feels like. The last time they did that was in 2000, a 2001 season. They had the talent there. But this Sixers team is really in a world of hurt right now. Their coach is gone. James Harden, I think, announced that he's going to decline his player option and is looking to re-sign or go sign with Houston. So it's like Joel Embiid on an island now at this point, and it's really going to be difficult for the Sixers team to somewhat rebuild or retool this roster without somebody like James Harden. Moving on to the second story, EA Sports announced that his contract with One Team Partners to facilitate collegiate athletes' name and likenesses into their new college football game. The partnership will include the chances for all eligible FBS players to opt in to have their likeness in the EA Sports college football, with players receiving compensation for being placed in the game. If a player does not want to be in the game, EA Sports will create a generic avatar and player in that athlete's place. The first college football game since 2013 of July is set to release in summer of 2024. Nathan, what are your thoughts on EA Sports releasing this new game and all this stuff coming out about it now?
Alex, you know I'm ready. We both, I'm sure everyone we know has played the NCAA title games, not just football, basketball too, you know, growing up. And it's been one of the biggest things I've missed, just being able to, you know, play with Alabama teams and just, you know, use every single college player I like. That's been a big miss for me. So just hearing, I remember when the whole name, likeness thing came out, the NIL all came out, and I knew that we would be getting a new college football game. I was so excited, but now, you know, since EA has kind of moved it a little bit, it's in motion, it's actually happening. You know, I know we're still a year away from actually getting it, but it's almost here, and I'm ready.
Yeah, I've been playing the NCAA 14 since it came out. I mean, I'm still playing it to this day, and that's really because there's this this, I guess, group of people out there that did college football revamp, which is basically like a file you put onto the NCAA 14 game, and it kind of just redoes it. There's new logos and stuff on there. It's kind of updated the game. And some of those people are working on this new NCAA football game, and I'm really excited for that because they did a good job with it revamped. I'm really excited for this game. I really hope they don't use the Madden engine for it, because Nathan, you and I both know we are not huge fans of Madden.
Oh, don't get me started, currently. Alex. We don't have enough time for that.
But this game is, I have high hopes for it. If this flops, EA Sports is just like the Sixers are going to be for a world of hurt here, because I mean, you have Madden, like I mentioned, has been down for years. I think last good Madden was like Madden like 13, something like that back then. And NCAA 14 was the last good college football game, or football game, I think, for that matter. So I mean, EA Sports, a lot is going on this if they want to keep being the go-to company for football games.
Yeah, I guess the real question is how much are we gonna have to pay to play this game? You know how EA is always trying to take people's money. It's not just enough to just buy the base version of the game. You have to have some other crap that they just want to throw at you. So it's gonna be interesting to see how they ruin this game.
Yeah, in the past, I mean, with the old NCAA games, there wasn't really any microtransactions. You could just go in and play the game, play Dynasty Mode, Road to Glory. I hope that stays like that.
Yeah,
because I prefer it be like that.
Alex, you got to remember, though, we're in 2023, and this is EA Sports.
Yeah, I really hope that, you know, I'm able to get it when it comes out, and I don't have to wait 2 or 3 months like I'm expecting, because this game is going to be in high demand. I think they're going to not make enough copies for it. You're probably going to have to wait 2 or 3 months to get it. And if you don't want to wait, it's probably going to be in the resale market for upwards of $100. But
or
I hope it's
just
not.
Just get a digital version like everyone else.
That's
modern,
true.
Modern people will get the digital version, Alex.
Yeah, that's true. Moving on to the third story, the ACC's annual spring meetings began this past week, and the league is optimistic about reaching an agreement on a new revenue model. However, it has been reported by SI Insider Ross Dellinger that 7 current ACC members, Clemson, Florida State, North Carolina, Miami, NC State, Virginia, and Virginia Tech, have been in private to determine how unbreakable the conference's current agreement really is. Nathan, we've seen it with the Pac-12 a couple months ago and still currently, and now we see with the ACC, these teams in these conferences are not happy with how they're getting paid with their revenue split. So do you think we're going to see to where there's maybe a big three with the Big Ten, Big 12, and SEC?
You know, it's really hard to say. You know, you talk about the total division of a whole conference. The ACC has been around for a while. It's been, you know, part of the Power Five. It contains some of the biggest teams. But whenever one of these larger teams, like Clemson, for example, is unhappy, you talk about, you know, the ACC's contract with ESPN and how they split the money, and it's nowhere near what a team from the SEC or Big Ten would get. Obviously, it makes it hard for these ACC teams to compete against these other conferences. So, you know, being able to reach a new deal, of course, you know, ESPN has their contract with the ACC until 2036. That's a while away. I mean, I can't even think about tomorrow, much less how many 13 years from now. So the fact is they're gonna have to reach a new deal. These teams, especially a team like Clemson, needs to be able to make more money. Whether that come from the division of the conference and then going and joining a conference like the SEC or Big Ten or Big 12, whatever they decide to do to just improve their university. If not, the ACC should try to find a way to work around the current contract they have, maybe prioritize certain teams like Clemson, who bring a lot more to the table than a team like Wake Forest or some of these smaller schools that are in the ACC. So it's all going to be determined on what these teams meeting and what they decide to do.
Yeah, I think, like you mentioned, Nathan, signing that contract through 2036 with ESPN was a really dumb move. I think at the time, people were kind of happy about it. But now, looking at it now, I mean, you have the Big Ten and the SEC getting these huge contracts for media rights. And the ACC is really lacking behind that, and they kind of screwed themselves. I think that's really going to be a hamper to this conference. I really expect them not to be around in the next decade or so. If you look at the bylaws for the ACC, they need 8 out of 14 teams to vote to dissolve entirely. And there is 7 teams already trying to look to get out of the conference. So they really just need one more team, like a Wake Forest or a Duke or a Pitt, to just go ahead and say, yeah, we're with y'all. We'll dissolve this conference. We want to go somewhere else, get more money. But I really expect that to happen, whether it be this season or five years down the road, but it's going to happen. So Nathan, looking at the ACC schools, let's just look at, you know, Clemson, FSU, Miami, really the big three, if you will, for the teams that are going to be the highest on people's boards to get to their conference. Where do you think each of those teams lands?
I mean, I looked at, you know, two teams in Clemson, FSU, to go ahead and join the SEC. Miami's a wild card. I could see them joining the SEC, but I could also see them trying to join the Big Ten. At this point, location for schools does not matter in the conference. Just look at, you know, yeah, teams like USC and UCLA just going and joining whoever they want to. So location doesn't really matter anymore with these conferences. So it is entirely possible that a team like Miami could try to go and join the Big Ten. But I think a team like Clemson, a team like FSU fits more into, you know, the SEC conference based on location, based on culture. So I think that those two would probably be a lot to go to the SEC. Miami, you know, you could probably flip a coin to figure out where they go.
Yeah, for me, I look at Clemson. I mean, the SEC already has South Carolina in that state. Clemson's obviously the better football team. Basketball, they proved they're better this year, but overall, I think South Carolina has had more success in basketball. That's here nor there. I mean, Clemson, I think it's really a toss-up for me. I could see them going either the Big Ten or SEC. I think it really just depends on who gives them the better deal, where they feel more comfortable. FSU, I would like to see them in the SEC just because there's a lot of rivalries there. You had the Auburn-FSU rivalry back in the day with the Bowdens. So I think that'd be a great addition there. But once again, SEC already has Florida. But I think FSU still would be a better addition. Miami, like you mentioned, Nathan, it's really a toss-up. Miami, we've seen in the past, has not had success in football, even though they hired Mario Cristobal. Their basketball team made the Final Four, so there's that. But Miami, I think, could go either way. I would expect them, if they were to pick a conference, go to the Big Ten. But I think what would be surprising for a lot of people is if they went somewhere like the Big 12. And we saw UCF go there. So who's to say Miami might not jump there as well? All right, Nathan, what do you got for USFL Week 6 for us?
You know, we're coming down to the wire here. We're almost to the playoffs, but, you know, we got four more weeks, realistically three now. You know, Week 6 was pretty interesting. Going ahead and jumping into the awards, the Offensive Player of the Week being Birmingham Stallions quarterback Alex Magoo, who was 19-24, 133 passing yards, 82 rushing yards, and three total touchdowns. The co-defensive players of the week, one being Pittsburgh Maulers linebacker Kavaya Tizino, who had 16 tackles, 11 solo tackles, two tackles for losses, and he's joined by Michigan Panthers linebacker Frank Ginda with 18 tackles, a half a sack, and one forced fumble. The special teams player of the week being New Orleans Breaker kick returner Derek Dillon, who had two returns for 158 yards, including a 109-yard kick six for a touchdown. He plays for the Showboats, actually. But, I mean, you can talk about that play. We'll get into it here in a minute. Alex, how do you feel about there being two defensive players of the week?
I think it was kind of difficult for people to pick between these two guys. There really wasn't a guy that separated himself this week, to be honest with you. I mean, neither of these winners, their team won this week, so that really shows you how difficult it was for somebody to pick a defensive player of the week. I think both these guys really deserved it. They're both leaders of their team. But, I mean, defense, I was really surprised that somebody like Amani Dennis of the Philadelphia Stars didn't win, who was kind of different in that game. He had an interception return for a touchdown. But nonetheless, I mean, these guys had great weeks.
Jumping into our first game of the weekend, the Maulers took on the Showboats, a game we really thought the Maulers would win, but they do not even score. The Memphis Showboats take care of business 22-0, giving us our first shutout of the season. You know, I really expected the Maulers to do better, especially with how their offense had performed the past few weeks. It looked like they've been better. Troy Williams is really holding his own as the quarterback, but in this game, it just came down to them not being able to get into the red zone and score. The Maulers outgained the Showboats 283 yards to the Showboats 223. Yet, you know, they weren't able to get into the red zone. They only averaged 5 yards a play, which isn't terrible. But Troy Williams just did not have an impressive game. He was 13-19, 145 passing yards, but he had an interception. We had, you know, quarterback James Warren come in and try to give him some relief. He had two interceptions. So it really comes back down to them not having a really good quarterback situation, even though Troy Williams had better weeks in the past. You talk about the Showboats team, you know, their offense wasn't great. But their main part being their special teams, you talk about Derek Dillon and the legendary 109-yard kick six return for a touchdown. That just took all the air out of the stadium. I mean, at that point, you knew Memphis was going to win the game. But special teams has really been high for the Showboats. Not only their kicking return game, but, you know, their place kicking game. They've been able to take advantage of even when they don't get into the red zone, even when they don't get into the end zone, they've been able to, you know, basically have a guaranteed field goal every single time. Cole Kelly as a quarterback, he hasn't looked super impressive, Alex. I mean, he went 14-24, 135 passing yards and a touchdown. But it really seems like he is carried not only by his defense, but by his running back, Juwan Washington, who had 20 carries for 71 yards. I know that isn't great efficiency, but still, it takes a lot of weight off his back, something that a quarterback in Troy Williams does not have for the Maulers. Alex, were you surprised by this result?
I really was. I thought the Maulers were on the up and up. Troy Williams looked great the past couple of weeks, and he comes out here and plays like crap. I said it in our USFL show on our YouTube that Troy Williams has been the entire offense for the Maulers. And if the Showboats were able to contain him on the run game, this Maulers offense is going to be in for a struggle. And they did. They held Troy Williams to 7 yards on four carries. And he was really forced to, you know, pass the ball. He had somewhat of a successful passing game, like you mentioned, Nathan. But it really came down to the fact the Maulers could not run the ball at all. I mean, their leading rusher was a wide receiver, Bailey Gaither, who had two carries for 16 yards. I don't know how you manage to have a wide receiver lead your team in rushing in the USFL right now, especially with how many running backs there are that are great. This Maulers team, it looks like they're back in week one and the way they played this game. Their defense played great. They just couldn't force a turnover, which is a big thing for this Maulers defense, who was really the part of the team that keeps them going. So there's just that for the Maulers. And look at the Showboats, Cole Kelly. He just continues to be a game manager, like I continue to mention. He played to the best of his ability. He didn't throw an interception, didn't turn the ball over. But in this league, it looks like, you know, defense doesn't win championships or games. It looks like special teams win you games and championships. We've seen it with Deion Kane for the Stallions, Luis Aguilar, the kicker last week for the Stars. And this week you had Derek Dillon for the Showboats with that kick six return touchdown. That was a real difference for them. I think that catapulted them ahead of the Maulers for the game. So the Showboats, good win for them. The South Division is really getting competitive if you look at it coming up.
Yeah, at this point, Alex, there's no normality in this league. I can't tell you. You have to run the ball. You have to play defense. You have to do all of the above. But you also have to have a good special teams. If you don't have that, I guess you're not going to win a game. Or something weird is going to have to happen. moving on to our second game of the weekend, the Birmingham Stallions took on the Michigan Panthers. Birmingham ended up getting the win 27-13. You know, you talk about a competitive game at the start. It looked like the Michigan Panthers were going to be able to move the offense, the ball a little bit better in an offensive end. But quarterback Josh Love got blitzed out of his mind. You know, I think that we don't give enough credit to the Stallions defense. They were able to get in the backfield almost every single play. Even though they only got two sacks, they were pressuring Josh Love, you know, forced a lot of bad decisions. One of the first drives, I know it was canceled out by the penalty, they forced a fumble on him. It seems like they were getting to him every single time. You know, there's just a lot to say about the Stallions defensive line. I think they've improved a lot, especially since the Breakers week. But, you know, we got to talk about probably the best quarterback in the league, Alex McGough. He just does everything for this offense. Alex, like we've talked about, you know, not only through the air, what he's able to do, but on the ground with his legs, with the limited number of attempts he gets. He is just insane. He makes the defense guess a lot. Ever since the Maulers week, he has been a lot more cautious with the ball. He hasn't made a lot of stupid decisions. He went 19-24, 133 passing yards, two touchdowns to the air, as well as, you know, getting 11 carries for 82 yards and a touchdown. You know, Alex, we've talked about the Stallions running game and how non-existent it's been. But CJ Marable, you know, he decided to wake up, 18 carries, 100 yards, three receptions for 16 yards and a touchdown through the air. You know, there's been a lot missing from the Stallions offense and the Stallions defense. They've been very, very injured, but they come out and they just look like a completely different team this week. Alex, would you speak on the Panthers situation a little bit? Because I don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah, it's just once again their quarterback play. Josh Love, he improved somewhat Carson Strong, their backup, didn't play, which is surprising to me. Josh Love, 222 passing yards, a touchdown, no turnovers, interceptions, fumbles otherwise. So that's good for him to see him, you know, control the ball there. But like you mentioned, Nathan, the Stallions defense was continuing to put pressure on him. That offensive line for the Panthers was atrocious. Looked like the Stars at that point. But their running game, Stevie Scott III and Reggie Corbin, didn't provide much relief for Josh Love. Reggie Corbin had 28 rushing yards. Stevie Scott had 46. Got to get more from one of those guys. Reggie Corbin's shown the ability to run the ball effectively in that 1 week where he had over 100 rushing yards. He's got to get back to that if this Panthers team is going to do more in this league. Trey Quinn, the receiver, had an amazing game. 7 receptions, 108 yards. He's really their bright spot. That's a good thing for this offense, which really lacks a bright spot in general. So good for Trey Quinn. Other defense for the Panthers, you know, Frank Ginda, one defensive player of the week. He continues to be great, a great leader for them. Breland Speaks, he seems to have woke up from his nap he had earlier in the season, had 12 tackles, half a sack. He was all over the place. But the Panthers defense can play great, but when their offense really struggles to get the running game going and Josh Love just gets pressured out of his mind because the offensive line can't block, it's going to be difficult for the Panthers team to win football games. But looking at the Stallions, like you mentioned, Nathan, Alex Magoo is the engine that keeps this team going. I mean, every week he seems to just have the team on his back, playing lights out football. Doesn't make many mistakes. No turnovers this game, no fumbles. So that's good for him. C.J. Marable, we've called all season, like you mentioned, Nathan, to get this running game going. And C.J. Marable did it this week with 100 rushing yards. That's a good thing for him to see. But one thing that really worries me for the Stallions offense is really their inability to get big chunk plays in the passing game. I mean, this game, their leading receiver had 37 receiving yards. And if they're going to compete with somebody like the Breakers or maybe the Gamblers, they got to get these chunk plays in the passing game or they're really going to struggle, especially when the running game in certain games really struggles as well. So you got to look for that. But getting JoJo Tillery back for that defense was also great. So I think the Stallions team, if they can get people back from injuries like JoJo Tillery was this game, it'll be great. And the Stallions will be poised for success.
Yeah, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about the play before the end of the half. Josh Love threw a beautiful pass. It got them all the way down, I believe, inside the Stallions 20. And of course, they had no timeouts left. It was around 20 seconds left in the game. They had spiked the ball, and they ran a play. They didn't get the first down. They were supposed to come out and spike the ball and, you know, attempt a field goal. But instead, what happened, Josh Love takes it and tries to make a play, and they end up getting no points. And they go into halftime pretty depressed, I would say. Josh Love looks like a big idiot there. Alex, I don't know if you saw that, but I'd say that was probably the turning point in this game. It seems like it was competitive all the way up until that point. Do you feel like there might be a chemistry issue between Josh Love and some of the other members of his offense?
I mean, I think there is. You look at how many times they have to rotate Carson Strong into the game. Having a two quarterback system we've seen in this league really does not work effectively. So I think him getting, you know, having to switch out back and forth with Carson Strong hurts his chemistry with the team.
Moving on to our first game from Sunday, Alex, you know, like we talked about, there is no normality in this league. We thought that the Breakers were going to be that one team that was just, you know, above the rest. But the Philadelphia Stars, like we talked about, like how many problems they've had, they come out and they end up beating the Breakers 16-10. The Breakers dominated time of possession with 32 minutes to the Stars just 27. But the Stars were able to outgain the Breakers 362 yards to the Breakers 256. But I think what it comes down to, again, just like last week, McLeod Bethel-Thompson ended up with two interceptions. He made some poor decisions on that end. You know, Case Cookies, he didn't have an incredible game. He had two interceptions as well. So this was not an offensive game. But what it comes down to, Case Cookies getting help. You know, Luis Aguilar continues to be, you know, just lights out for him. He was 3 out of 4 on field goal attempts. Really won him the game for a second week in a row. I didn't think I'd be saying that, Alex. When we talked about this game and we introed it on our USFL show, I said there's no way that Luis Aguilar comes out here and wins them another game, and yet he does. The Breakers have not looked like the same team since their performance against the Stallions. Wes Hill's situation, he's kind of been figured out a little bit. He had a better week this week with 18 carries, 74 yards, and five receptions for 30 yards. But he's not been the same dominant runner as we've seen. You talk about Bethel Thompson for a minute. It just seems so uncharacteristic for him to be having these turnovers in these games, especially how limited he was, at the beginning of the season. This just does not look like the same offense. Say Terrett has not been able to get the ball as much, only getting four receptions for 24 yards. So he's definitely not been as dominant. And you talk about this Breakers defense, they can't do it all by themselves. Alex, if you were coaching the Breakers right now, how would you fix their offense?
I mean, you just got to call better plays. I mean, it looks like this coach, DeFilippo, can't make adjustments. The Showboats figured him out last week. It looked like they came out with the same game plan this week. The Breakers just uncharacteristic turnovers by Bethel Thompson. Wes Hills can't get over 100 yards anymore. I mean, like you mentioned, the people have kind of figured out Wes Hills almost. And Bethel Thompson just throws the ball into the other team's hands. And they just got to do better. They got to figure out how to make adjustments. If not, this team's, you mentioned on the show, you wouldn't be surprised if they missed the playoffs. If they don't make adjustments, they might not. There's a lot of games left in the season. So the Breakers really got to make some adjustments if they're going to come out here and make the playoffs. But looking at the stars, Case Cookes, like you mentioned, Nathan, doesn't have a great game. No touchdowns, two interceptions. But shout out to Matt Colburn, 13 carries, 62 yards. I think we should throw a pizza party for him. He actually got over 50 rushing yards this game. Whoop-de-doo for him. But the real star for the Stars was their defense. They had two sacks, three TFLs, and two interceptions, one of which was returned for a touchdown by defensive backer Amani Dennis. That was the icing on the cake for that team, who ended up winning the game by 6 points. So the Stars continue to find ways to win football games, and now they're atop the North Division by one game.
Yeah, you talk about the situation in the North. You now have a three-way tie in the South with, three teams being 4-2. It's really going to come down to who gets out, who gets these playoff spots. Right now, I think, the team we're about to talk about, the Game Warriors, are pretty comfortable in their situation, especially having the head-to-head victory against the Stallions. Moving on to our last game of the week, the New Jersey Generals took on the Houston Gamblers, and the same score, same ending score as the Philadelphia Stars and New Orleans Breakers game. The Gamblers got it done 16-10. I don't know how many games you have with the same ending score like that, but someone could figure that out for me. The Gamblers dominated time possession 32 minutes to the Generals just 27. It really seemed like this Generals offense could not get anything going. Kyle Lauletta really struggled early on. I think it must have been really a rhythm thing for him. He is new to the system. This is his first start, so it's nothing new to have those first game jitters. Kenji Bahar returned. He didn't do anything off the charts. He just played a really, really game manager type game. But Alan Swite, like we talked about for a few weeks now, Mark Thompson has just been one of the best running backs in the league, if not the best running back. He had 22 carries for 82 yards and a touchdown. He just seems like the type of running back that Wes Hills was. But he was able to get it done. I really don't have a lot to talk about with this Generals team. I mean, it seems like every single week they just cannot figure out on the offensive end. Their defense can only do so much. In a game where they were originally just down, 16-0, they had time to come back, and they just weren't able to. 16 points is not a lot. It's three scores right there, if you think about it. So if this Generals offense cannot do anything to, figure out in the red zone, if they cannot convert, then I don't see them making the playoffs at this point. It's pathetic.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really tough game to watch if you like watching some high-powered offenses. Kyle Lauletta, like you mentioned, Nathan, I think it was really a rhythm thing, him just being his first start with the team. I think he'll be better next week if he gets the opportunity to start. But for the Generals, coming into the season, I thought they had the best running back duo in the league with Darius Victor and Trey Williams, and they come out here and don't play good. I mean, Darius Victor had 10 carries for 38 yards, and congratulations, didn't fumble the ball three times again. And then you had Trey Williams with four carries for 14 yards. I mean, when you have a new starting quarterback, you got to get help from your running game, and they didn't need but either of those guys. I was really expecting Cam Eccles-Looper, who's been really their go-to guy this season, to do better, but he had zero catches on two targets. This Generals team, Brody's can't figure out anything, it looks like, on their offensive side of the football. They can't get a rhythm going. They continue to try to rotate these quarterbacks in and out. It's just a real struggle for this team. But they really get lucky that they're in the North, because even though they are 2-4, they have opportunity to make the playoffs. But then looking at the Gamblers, couldn't get in the red zone for touchdowns, one out of four on that. Kenji Bahar did not have a great of a game. Looks like he was probably still struggling with a little bit of an injury there. Hopefully he can get back to full strength. When he looked like one of the best quarterbacks in the league. But Mark Thompson was really different for this Gamblers team when in the game, like you mentioned, Nathan, with his touchdown on 82 yards. That's good to see. And Justin Hall, who continues to be one of the best receivers, if not the best in the league, played great again with 6 receptions, 59 yards. So the Gamblers team, while they did struggle to find the red zone, you know, they did end up winning the game, got lucky that their defense stepped up, and the Generals just sucked.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about this Generals offense, Kyle Loetta has no help. You look at just some of his receivers, Warren Newman, probably one of his best receivers. He had 5 receptions for 55 yards. Alonzo Moore, 5 receptions, 44 yards and a touchdown. Jamon Moore, 2 receptions for 30 yards. And his tight end, Braden Bowman, who only had 2 receptions for 14 yards. He just seems to not have a lot of help. It seems like his receivers just do not want to get open. And like you talked about, Alex, with the new quarterback, you got to have some help from the running game. Darius Victor, you know, he looked a lot better last season. This season, he just seems out of his element. I don't know what's happened to him, but he really needed to step up in this game, and he just didn't. Alex, you know, we had the NBA draft lottery happen last week. Some interesting things happened. I know you got a lot to talk about with that.
Yeah, unfortunately, Greg cannot attend today. I was really looking forward to his reaction to the fact the Hornets fell to 2. But the draft order we got for the 2023 NBA draft was 1, the San Antonio Spurs, 2, the Charlotte Hornets, 3, the Portland Trail Blazers, 4, Houston Rockets, 5, Detroit Pistons, 6, Orlando Magic, 7, Indiana Pacers, 8, Washington Wizards, 9, Utah Jazz, 10, Dallas Mavericks, the 11, Orlando Magic via the Chicago Bulls pick, 12, Oklahoma City Thunder, 13, the Toronto Raptors, and 14, the New Orleans Pelicans. If you look at that order, it remained as predicted by the odds until pick number 5, where the Pistons fell all the way from the best odds to the 5th pick. The Rockets and the Pistons were both tied for the number 1 odds, with the Spurs both falling outside the top 3, which is really surprising to me. But the Spurs ended up getting the number 1 pick. I was not really surprised, considering, you know, Victor Wembanyama is the number 1 prospect in this draft class from France. The Spurs have a relationship with people from France like Tony Parker, who played point guard there, Boris Diaw. And, you know, the Spurs really have been known for how they develop big men. They had the pick back in 1987, got David Robinson. In 1997, got Tim Duncan. And once again, they get the first overall pick here and, you know, get Victor Wembanyama. Listen, Nathan, what are your thoughts on the Spurs getting the number 1 overall pick? Do you think it was rigged?
You know, it's one of those situations that you look at here they've had in the past, and it almost seems very convenient that they just move up to the number 1 spot. at the end of the day, I don't think it's rigged. I think it's just, you know, a coincidence that it happened. I mean, the Spurs were awful last season. They did have a great chance of getting that number 1 pick. So I think it's just, you know, a coincidence that it happened. As far as Victor Wembanyama's situation, obviously, you know, it dispersed. Pass him at first, I think they should just dissolve their franchise. I don't think that they should be allowed to even, you know, it's going to be one of those forbidden team names. But I don't think there's any chance that it happens. I think that Wembanyama, you talk about what Greg Popovich likes to do, how more controlled he is, kind of limiting his star players to what they're able to do on the offensive end. We know how flashy Victor Wembanyama is, so I think he's going to have somewhat of a limited game. You look at the defensive side, I think it's going to be one of the situations he's going to rely heavily on Victor Wembanyama to play some really, really good defense. I think it's going to be a very big challenge for him, given that Wembanyama is not super strong. He's not super muscular. So going into these bigger centers like Joel Embiid, like Jokic, who might have a little bit more weight on him, I think it's going to be interesting to see how he takes on those guys. But I think Greg Popovich is going to form him into a really, really good player.
Yeah, it's really going to come down to him putting muscle on his frame. We saw Giannis was able to do it. You got Chet Holmgren from the Thunder last year, who was really lanky as well. He's got to be able to do that too, because the center's position in this league, it's beginning more physical. Yeah, like you mentioned, the guys like Nikola Jokic, Joel Embiid as well. So you got to get some muscle on that frame if you're going to be able to compete at the NBA level. We look at number two, Nathan. The Charlotte Hornets fell there. I was really surprised that they got all the way up to number two. When it came down to them, the Spurs and the Hornets, I was really on the edge of my seat. I know Gray was as well. But what do you think the Hornets are going to do here? Because obviously, Scoot Henderson is probably the best player on the board at this point if Victor Wembanyama goes number one. But you also got Brandon Miller, who probably fits his team a little bit better because Scoot Henderson plays point guard. The Hornets have LaMelo Ball, Terry Rozier, and Brandon Miller plays more of that small forward wing position. And, you know, they have Gordon Hayward there, but he's a little bit on the older side. So, you know, I think he probably fit that team better. But who do you think the Hornets go with at number two?
You know, first of all, I got to thank the NBA because if this was rigged, I really appreciate them putting the Charlotte Hornets number two. You know, I really wish Ray was here to speak on the situation of the Hornets. We'd be here for hours if that were to happen. But, I mean, you talked about the Hornets just coming up this close to a generational center prospect. I mean, you can go on and on about how many generational players that they've just missed on. And they miss out on another one here. But my main message to Hornets fans, do not be disappointed. I know it's, you know, hard to look at, you know, one of the best centers that could ever play the game and you just miss on them. But you had two really, really good options. Number one, Scoot Henderson, which could be a really, really good point guard prospect. But I think, you know, overall the better fit here being the generational small forward and Brandon Miller, 6'9", you know, plays two-way. He's really good at facilitating. He's really good at finishing. He's improved so much on the defensive end of the floor. Not to mention his shooting is just knocked lights out. You know, with exception to March Madness, he didn't have a good performance there. But you talk about a guy who it's just really he's generational in a sense. So even though you don't get Wembanyama, you have the opportunity to go and get either one of these guys who, you know, look to be generational in my eyes.
I think you look at the Hornets team, you just got to go best available. I think at some point last season, their entire starting lineup was like G League caliber players. So you just got to go best available. And in my opinion, Scoot Henderson is the best available player on the board at number two. He's getting mentored by Steph Curry, which is really enticing to me if you're looking at if you're a Hornets front office guy. I think he'll do great things alongside LaMelo Ball. I think those guys are pair well together. If they're able to get Miles Bridges back as well, that team looks really solid, really poised for the future. But I wouldn't be surprised to take Brandon Miller here. Like you mentioned, Nathan, how lanky he is. He plays two-way. He's probably more a better fit with the current roster construction. But I think Scoot Henderson is the guy you go with if you're the Hornets. So, Nathan, looking at the top five, what would be your top five mock draft picks?
Yeah, of course, you go Wimby number one. I think that's a no-brainer. Like I just talked about, I think Brandon Miller goes two, leaving the Blazers to take Scoot Henderson three. That'd be if they do not trade their pick, which I have heard about. And then you look at this Rockets team, I think Amen Thompson is going to be a good fit there. And then I have Detroit taking Azar Thompson. So both Thompson twins going back to back. I think that they're really good prospects. I'm a little bit more held back on them just to see what they can do in the NBA. I know in the league that he played in was a little bit more lenient and more flashy than what we see in college or the G League. So it's going to be interesting to see what they do. But, you know, I think you really just look at, you know, this Blazers pick. And if they do decide to trade it, who would they trade it to? You look at teams that have needs. Could we see the Oklahoma City Thunder move up into third and try to get a guy in Brandon Miller to help space the four with Shea? I think it's entirely plausible that it happens, but you really wonder what the Oklahoma City would have to give up to get it.
Yeah, for me, at number one, obviously, Victor Wembanyama. Number two, I think the Hornets go Scoot Henderson, like I just mentioned. Number three, I definitely think the Trailblazers go Brandon Miller, regardless if Damian Lillard's still there or not. The Trailblazers starting small forward last year, Jeremy Grant, was on an expiring contract. Not 100% sure if they bring him back. If they don't, I think Brandon Miller would be a great fill-in for him at the small forward position. He's just a great scorer. He'd pair well with somebody like Damian Lillard, great defensive player. So I think that's where they go. And then look at number four for the Rockets. I think they stay in state – in city and go with the Houston guy, Jairus Walker, the power forward. We've seen with the Rockets, they got their guards. They got Kevin Porter and Jalen Green. They got Jabari Smith Jr. last year to play small forward. They got Sengun at center. The real question mark is really the power forward position. I think Jairus Walker pairs well with a guy like Alperen Sengun. Sengun is definitely more of a Nikola Jokic type player, a facilitator type, not a, you know, a spectacular defensive player. Jairus Walker is definitely what you want to see in a rim protector type player. Really versatile. I think he'll pair well with Sengun. And I think it'll be a great fit for this Rockets team who continues to just rebuild this roster. And moving to number five, for me, it comes down to the Cam Whitmore from Villanova or Asar Thompson from the Overtime Elite League. I think for me, it's going to be Asar Thompson. He looks better in film to me. He profiles better. He'll be a great guy to pair alongside Cade Cunningham, Jaden Ivey, and the centers they got there, the plethora of them they have. In James Wiseman, Jalen Duren, Isaiah Stewart, and Marvin Bagley. This Pistons team, even though they didn't get the number one overall pick, did get number five. I mean, they're going to have the opportunity to get a really great player. So, Nathan, before we get out of here, the Thunder did end up being number 12, the 12th pick. Obviously, you probably wanted them to maybe leap up to the top four, top five. But who do you think the Thunder get at 12?
You know, if we do say at 12, you know, I'm hoping a guy like Jairus Walker just miraculously falls to the 12th pick. If not, I would like us to try to trade up, whether that be trying to go after the Trailblazers pick or the Pistons pick, to try to get either a guy in Jairus Walker or Brandon Miller. I think either of those guys would be good, especially Jairus Walker. You talked about how awful, how atrocious the Thunder are at the center position. It is a huge need. We need a lot of defense, especially after that play-in game against the Timberwolves.
Yeah, I think the Thunder really have to address that big man position. But you look at this draft class, outside of Victor Wembanyama and a guy like Jairus Walker, there really isn't a big man you look at and go, you know, he's a lottery pick lock there. I mean, Noah Clowney is a good guy to look at, but, you know, he's not really even first-round talent, in my opinion. Zach Edey, Nathan, I know you don't like him.
Don't even get into it.
I mean, he's like the only other center I look at in this draft class and go, you know, maybe he can help out the Thunder. But he's obviously definitely not worth the 12th overall pick. So the Thunder team are really, really in a weird position because they don't need a guard, but they need a center or a big man, and there's not a lot available at 12. But hopefully they get lucky and Jairus Walker falls to him, like you mentioned, Nathan, but we will see. All right, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to Students of the Game.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.